apparently he knows a lot of people. That's how it's turned out.
Yeah, people are aware of him.
Yes,
I think
yes.
That's the, yeah.
Dee Wallace giving him a shout out yesterday for work in Cujo back in the 80s as well. We get the program underway this afternoon by welcoming to the show an acclaimed director of both film and television. Movies like Outside In, Hump Day, Your Sister's Sister, a ton of television credits, including directing episodes of Mad Men, New Girl, Master of None, Shameless, and Glow. She's got a brand new movie out, a terrific film called Sword of Trust that stars Marc Maron. We are pleased to welcome Lynn Shelton to the show this afternoon. Lynn, thanks for being with us. How are you?
I'm good, Rich. How are you?
I am wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's been a quest. We've been trying to get you for a long time. I've been such a fan of your work for so many years, and this new movie is just absolutely wonderful. Everything about it, the cast, the direction, the writing, the cinematography, kudos on just a wonderful movie.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. I like it. I like that kind of enthusiasm. Very nice to hear.
Well, the cast is great, and I wonder, so much of your work is done through improvisation. Do you look for people who are comfortable with working in an improvisational setting?
Oh, for sure. There are lots of actors. Some of my favorite actors on earth are not great improvisers, and that's totally fine. They have another kind of magic, which is to take the written word and turn it into something that it seems like a real person would say. But I knew that I needed a very carefully curated cast to pull this movie off. And that cast had to include people, every single one of whom had to be able to, find their way to the beats of the scene. They really are, it's a very special brain, you know. It's somebody who is able to create an emotionally truthful performance and a real well-rounded character, but also is a writer, you know, to some degree, and is able to just like let words come out of their mouths that is appropriate to the scenario. And if it can also elicit a little laughter, all the better in this case anyway.
Well, casting is perfect in this. And of course, it starts with Marc Maron. You'd worked with him on Glow, on his series. I think you'd done a comedy special with him. But when did you know you wanted to make a film with Marc?
I knew I wanted to make a film with Marc the first time I directed him on his show, Maron. So that was back in 2000, very beginning of 2016, because I met him in 2015, almost 4 years ago, exactly 4 years ago, on his WTF podcast. And he kind of hired me on the spot, asked me if I would direct his TV show his last season. And I said, yeah, no problem. I'd love to. And it was a very vulnerable kind of moment in the scope of the series for his character, because he had fallen off the wagon. Mm. His character had fallen off the wagon and he'd lost everything. And he was hitting rock bottom in the first episode of that show, that season. And then he ends up going into rehab. And you know, he was giving himself acting challenges that he had never done before, you know, and he really learned how to act in that show that he created for himself. So the first season, the difference between his acting performance in the first season compared to the fourth season is kind of remarkable, because he just taught himself how to act. And he ended up being, by the time I worked with him, it was like, wow, this guy, he was still a little raw in terms of his talent, but man, did he have a lot to give. And he really understood how to engage and how to listen and how to make himself available emotionally. And I just saw untapped depths there that I wanted to see myself and I wanted the world to see. So I asked him if he would collaborate with me on something. And we actually started to write a script for another movie. And it just was so slow going, because I don't think he ever really understood that as soon as we had a script, I would make it, you know, but he'd never been through that process before. So he just kept kind of being very lackadaisical about it. And I finally said, look, I really want to get on set with you again. And I really want to put you at the center of a movie. And he said, well, if you write another movie, you know, on your own, I'll do it. And so I did. I just came to him a few months later. And I was like, okay, it's done. Give me your 2 weeks that you promised me. You know, we're going to go make this movie. And he couldn't believe it.
I love his podcast. Yeah, you've been on a couple of times. I think it's the best podcast out there. He's such a good interviewer, and that starts with his ability to listen. And I have to think, well, obviously for any actor, that's a great skill, as you mentioned, but particularly if you're doing a lot of improvisation, listening is just going to make you live in that moment so much more.
That is absolutely correct. And I just did a press tour with him in New York, and listening to him talk about that very thing, how the podcast is what kind of enabled him to learn how to act, because he had to learn how to listen, and he had to learn how to give somebody else, you know, stage time, to, you know, so to speak, metaphorically, because his, you know, first and foremost, he is a comic. He stands on stage and he takes full ownership of that space, and he's responsible for filling the void with his own words. And he's not used to playing well with others. You know, he doesn't come from the Groundlings or UCB or any kind of comedy improv scenario where you're being generous with you know, letting other people kind of have their jazz solos, you know. He was just the soloist himself. So doing that podcast really, really enacted, you know, it sort of activated brand new skills for him. And he really had to learn how to listen and to let other people talk. And that enabled him to, it turned out to be really good groundwork for acting, as you say.
I read an interview recently, may have been on the New York tour, where he talked about the fact that he wasn't aware of the camera. And that's, yeah. I think you said, wow, what a gift that is to have that, to be so locked in with your scene partner that you forget about the camera.
Well, it is. And I've worked with a lot of folks who can't help but be aware of it, you know, and who are just so self-conscious about the fact that it's right there in their faces. And he has this really weird, beautiful ability to just shut all that out. And not just the camera, but the whole crew. You know, it's such an artificial setting. I mean, making a movie is a really, and TV shows, it's such a strange way of working because, you know, I always say everybody is working their ass off on set, but nobody has a harder job than the actor. And the good ones make it seem like breathing. They make it seem so easy. But it's really difficult to just completely shut out the weird light and all these weird people standing around staring at you, you know, and all the equipment, and to just home in on who you're talking to and what's going on emotionally in the scene, and then make yourself, you know, available emotionally. It's not an easy gig at all. And it's really kind of magical when somebody can make it work.
We're talking with Lynn Shelton about her wonderful new movie, Sword of Trust. Laugh out loud, funny, but the scenes that stand out to me are a couple of very poignant scenes. And one is early in the film when your character arrives. Were you reluctant at all to cast yourself in that role?
I was very reluctant, and I blame my co-writer, Mike O'Brien. Mike O'Brien is an amazing performer, but he's really made a living recently as a writer, but he never wanted to give up performing, and he just assumed I was the same way, because I started out as an actor, and then I really turned my attention to directing, and, you know, I love acting, but truth be told, I'd be happy to just direct the rest of my life and never act again, you know, but he just kept insisting that I had to take a role in the movie. And I kept saying, no, I'm not going to be in the movie, Mike. And I finally relented because he wouldn't let go of it. And I thought I was just going to be a random, very, you know, kind of like a tiny little cameo of just somebody who comes in. Like there's a character in the movie that comes in to pick up a coat that she pawned earlier. And I thought that was going to be me. I thought I would be doing something like that. But then I realized that, and I said, well, you know, I have always wanted to play a junkie, and I could imagine that somebody strung out coming in and wanting to, you know, pawn something so they could get drugs. So I thought, well, I'll be that. It'll be fun, you know? And then I realized that as we were writing the script, we needed some way to track Mel's emotional arc through the film. Mm-hmm. Mel is the character that Mark plays. And I realized that maybe this was an opportunity that her character could be a way to do that. And she wouldn't really have to show up in the movie more than just one real scene. And then another point, he sees her from a distance, but mostly she's just referred to, you know, after that, she does never have to be seen again. And so, we just ended up incorporating her into giving her more weight.
Well, it's great.
And I was really happy to be able to do that because I actually had a really wonderful time acting with Mark, and that was just sort of a gift that I wasn't expecting.
and it raises the emotional stakes and sets up that wonderful scene. And I have to say, it's the first time I can think of in a film where you had an incredible monologue delivered in the back of a box truck.
Yeah, and what's really amazing is that there were some scenes in that movie that were, I mean, the plot was really tightly structured, and there were many scenes, like the Mel Dirger scene actually was pretty well written out. honestly. It was loose the way we approached it, but it really was, you know, a lot of those lines were written. The back of the van scene, which is arguably the heart of the whole movie, it says in the script, they get to know each other in the back of the van. And then we spent an entire day, you know, figuring out what that scene was going to be. Now, everybody coming into by the time they came to set, they really had a strong sense of who their characters were and what their backstories were. So a lot of that groundwork had been done previously, but all the little details that get filled in, were happening on the day. You know, Mark comes up with all these details that he brings in from the time he spent in his youth in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And he, you know, refers to specific restaurants and just he sort of paints this picture in his head, this built memory that is not his own. You know, he sort of pictured himself and he remembered all of these folks on heroin in amongst the, you know, people that he was living with and living in that neighborhood with. And he just kind of like inserted this character's experience into that group of folks. And it really, it's kind of insane what he does. It's a kind of an alchemy that he creates. It's just beautiful.
One of your executive producers is Joe Swanberg, who's been on our show. We love his work. Mark Duplass is a great friend of ours who's been on a bunch of times. And you guys are labeled as people in the mumblecore genre. To me, that's always been an odd name for it, because I look at what's out there in the world of cinema, particularly in the summertime, and it's a lot of comic books and a lot of stuff blowing up. And I look at the movies that you make, that Joe makes, that Mark makes as movies for grown-ups and not mumblecore.
Yeah, totally agreed. Yes. And it's a pretty annoying at this point term, you know, that just kind of rankled a little bit. And I definitely think that whatever made that, you know, whoever came up with that moniker and whatever gave us that label is pretty tired by now, because, you know, it basically the only thing that was bringing us all together at the time where we weren't waiting for permission for other people, you know, from other people to make our films. It was very DIY. We just sort of grabbed cameras and grabbed friends and made movies. And we all got sort of, it was nice to be actually put together into a little bit of a movement, because I think it put more of a spotlight on all of our little films that would have been harder to shine had they just been coming out, you know, individually. But the name itself is so annoying, because I don't, you know, there's nobody mumbling in my movies.
No,
ever.
No.
So in any of ours, really, for that matter. So it's sort of a cute little thing that somebody, you know, sort of latched onto. But I think we're well beyond that label for sure. You know, even if it never, whether it fit or not at the time, it certainly doesn't anymore. You know, the scope of our films and the variety of approaches and budgets has long, you know, sort of left that behind, I think.
Well, I love the films you did with Mark Humpday. Your Sister's Sister was so wonderful. The film you did with Jay Duplass. And I guess I go back to improvisation, and in improv, the best humor comes out of truth and it comes out of reality. And it seems like the consistent thread in all of your films, Lynn, real people placed in somewhat extraordinary situations.
I would have to agree. That's true. I actually had somebody say to me the other night after a screening that she believes that comedy is empathy. And I was floored by that, because I really immediately saw what she meant. You know, she said, I really get a big belly laugh only when I feel like I recognize the people on the screen, which is exactly what I'm aiming for. You know, I want to create real people that you really care about, because you see their humanity, you know, and you feel their humanity, and that is empathy, you know, right there. So that's where the sort of full belly laughter, organic laughter comes from. And the thing that's nice about improvisation is that it creates a sensibility on the screen that's very dynamic, because you literally have no idea what each person is going to be saying. You know, it wasn't predetermined. And that's because that's how it was on the set, you know. And so there's a full engagement with the actors, each with the other, because you have to be really listening because you don't know what the other person is going to be saying. And no matter, you know, you're always suspending your disbelief when you're working with a predetermined script, because you know exactly what the person is going to say next, you know, after you say your line, and you have to pretend you don't know, you know, and that's a hard that's a hard road to toe. So if you really don't know what they're going to be saying, it's a lot easier to just like stay completely engaged and, you know, and really just tune in, you know, with all of your senses. And that comes across, I think, on screen.
It sure does. Well, Sword of Trust, it's everything I look for in a movie. It's smart, it's funny, it's poignant, and it's very, very honest. Lynn, I'm a big fan of your work. Congratulations on this terrific film. And thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, Rich, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Glad it finally happened.